to Canucks Central at noon.
Now works into the high slot and shoots. He scores. Quinn Hughes in overtime. And he's the leading rookie scorer in the NHL.
Your Vancouver Canucks live here.
Here's Horvat with a partial break down the left wing. Bo Horvat in clean. He scores. The captain does it again.
On the home of hockey, Sportsnet 650.
What is up? Happy Friday to you. Get set for a non-long weekend. I know these 4-day work weeks feel like they fly by. And then you think, why isn't every weekend 3 days? It's Vic Nizar, Dan Riccio here on the home of the Canucks and Canucks Central. Reach an hour away from Reach Deep, but joining us here now on Canucks Central after a week away.
Yeah,
how you been?
I've been good, man. I just want to say that is unequivocally your best take of all time.
What, the 3-day weekends?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's true. Like, you get through these 4 days, you're like, all right, it's the weekend. Oh, right.
It's only 2-day weekend. What the hell, man?
It's not the same. I maintain, actually, perhaps my best take is I maintain that we should all be doing 10-hour 4-day weeks instead of 8-hour 5-day weeks.
It's a pretty good take. I mean, we kind of are in the lucky side of this because all we do is like watch sports in our off hours.
Sure. Yes.
So technically, some might think of that as working all the time, but I guess we're lucky on that front. But the good thing about this weekend, Bick, is we aren't going to have to spend the entire time of it stressing about what the Canucks will or won't do or who's going to be the next Canuck to sign for the Calgary Flames.
This weekend shapes up much differently. Yeah, like, you're not going to be over your family's place having Thanksgiving dinner. Someone's handing you the yams, and you're like, oh, my God, what? Tanev now is gone to Calgary all over again? Hand me that pecan pie like Louis Domingue would make. Wait, Louis Domingue is gone to Calgary too? The worst news ever. It'll be much calmer, we think. However, there's still things percolating, right? You still want to plan despite potentially nothing happening. And that's part of what we do here. Obviously, you have the conversations that you can be a part of as well. 650-650 into our text message inbox. But I think we want to start here with some of the latest news that's going on in the NHL. Andrew Mangiapane signs a contract. Now, you know, this isn't Flames Central, but you see that contract, a guy who was... It's a two-year deal, 2.425 AAV, a really productive player. I think kind of gets overlooked about all the players in Calgary, right? Like Giordano and Goudreau and Monahan. Just a solid player for the Calgary Flames. But you look at what he did, it was, you know, a decent season statistically, 32 points in 68 games. And immediately everyone goes and says, all right, well, if that's what Mangiapane does as a winger and he gets his two-year deal in the mid-twos, what does that mean for Jake Virtanen, who had 36 points in 69 games?
It seems like a fairly reasonable comp to make. Now, a couple of differences here. Jake, a first-round pick. Mangiapane is not that. Another one is that Jake has played 150 or so more games than Mangiapane, so that generally does, you know, work in favor of Jake getting a little bit more in salary. So I think
he's got a bigger body of work.
Exactly. I think this is it as a comp, it would be on what the low end of where Jake will end up with his contract with the Canucks.
If you're the Vancouver Canucks and you actually wind up in arbitration somehow, which again is October 28th. If you wind up there, you're coming in with the Andrew Mangiapane contract and say, look, this is what this guy got. I know he got signed, but like, this is what we are kind of looking at, and that's where we value. Because that's what happens, right? It's not about necessarily being fair in arbitration. It's about making your case for either the lowest or, if you're the player side, the highest watermark, and you fall somewhere in there. And Yeah, this to me didn't feel like an exact comparable, but it is one that if you're the Canucks, you're going to walk in there and say, this is a guy who, you know, is putting a lot of work and he's getting in, raising his way up the lineup and got 32 points in 68 games. Jake's got a little bit more. Obviously, the pedigree is a bit different, but here's someone that we look at and how we value is kind of the price point that we want to pay. Now, he didn't go to arbitration. Is that something that gets resolved before then? We'll touch on that in just a minute. But I look at another contract across the league that if you are the Vertanen camp coming into this, it's the Robbie Fabbri deal. That was signed a while ago. But that's the one I look at and I say, you can get 2.9. And maybe you aim higher, to be honest, and you look for the mid to low threes. But that's the one that to me is a fair comparable to say 2.9 is about where we want to end up.
Vertanen is going to be shooting as high as he can, and that Fabbri one really is the better comp for him. Now, there's some other ones out there. Like, I looked up Valeri Nichushkin, and he's at 2.5 per, recently signed for 2 years with the Colorado Avalanche. He only scored 13 goals. And the season prior to that had zero. So the more I think about this pick, the more I look at it, the more I see it's going to be very difficult for the Canucks to get Jake at $2.5 million per. You may not like that, but that's just the reality of where the situation is lining up.
If it went to arbitration.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, if we end up in a spot where October 28th, no deals assigned, they got to go to arbitration, I feel like in that scenario, it's tough for the Canucks.
Well, if you're Jake, then why not just go to arbitration?
Right, but there might be term necessarily is also a thing, right?
Yeah. Like,
would you rather the short-term money or would you rather more over term?
Well, you could bet on yourself and say, yeah, I'm going to put up more points, and then I'll really solidify my place next summer.
Sure. If he lands somewhere at 2.6, 2.7 in a contract negotiation over 2 years, right? Like, say they just do the same thing here with Andrew Mangiapane and say, yeah, you can go to arbitration, but we're actually going to solve this and give you 2.7 over 2 years. Is that something that should be considered?
It's
hard to say no to $5.4 million.
Yeah, and look, the basis of it is, look, I'm going to spend 2.7 over the next 2 years on a player that could score 20 goals, helps out my second power play unit, at least he did this past year, and when we're in a pinch can play up the lineup, and at least our top guys kept scoring when he played further up the lineup. I know there's some other factors in there that don't ring as truly well for Jake Vertanen, but in a lot of cases, you would say that and be pretty comfortable with it. Okay, a potential 20-goal scorer helps out my top line when there's injuries or we want to shake things up. I can get behind this. And, I wonder if this is more about what it means for the Canucks or what it means for Jake as a trade asset when we're haggling over 100, 200, maybe 300K against the cap.
As in kind of just do the deal and figure out if it means you've now opened yourself up to a trade?
Yes. Like, if you keep the AAV as lower, you would think it makes Jake a little bit more valuable in a trade, especially if it's a term deal of 2 years, let's say.
Yeah, that makes sense. And the higher it creeps up, the more likely it means he's retained in Vancouver. If it hits three, that might be a tough contract for other teams to take on at this stage. Well, and look, I was thinking
every penny counts. Every penny counts right now around the league. We're seeing that every single day. It's proven to us.
I was just thinking about this too. And this isn't me advocating for this. This is just me thinking out loud. That, we harp on kind of that groupthink of everyone's thinking the same wing, the same way, and you know, how, if everyone does that, where's the value that that you're extracting to try to be different, to try to capitalize on inefficient things that are in the market? And right now, like, every GM is deadlocked and trying to move money out. And I guess the question I have is, are teams that are willing to take on money, or teams that can take on money because of their cap space, are they holding people's feet to the fire to take on a contract, or is it just the economic landscape that is right now that people don't want to? And if you were able to find a suitor, is it worth just kind of saying, you know what, screw it, I'm going to do this because I see the value. If nobody else is trying at something, I'm going to try it because I see the value in how I can improve my roster by way of free agency. So I'm going to lose this trade, but I'm going to improve it by way of free agency. I'm curious if that's going to happen. Now, there's the element to this of everyone's kind of waiting for these RFAs to sort themselves up, right? Because there's a lot of arb cases going around. And part of that is, can teams figure out where they are financially over these next, you know, 5 to 10 days, and then work towards moving money around? But the reason I would want to consider moving money around, and me maybe being more aggressive in that sense, is what Elliot Friedman tweeted yesterday. Hearing Mike Hoffman is considering a 1-year deal for his next NHL home. If he does that, there's a good chance that he and Taylor Hall head to market next summer as the leaders in goals per game for all free agents, 31 and under, deja vu all over again. Now, Evgeny Dadonov signs a contract yesterday, and my initial reaction was, well, if he got term, and if Tyler Toffoli got term, we're crafting these scenarios of 1-year contracts, and maybe you have to, you know, resign yourself to the Mikhail Granlunds of the world. But here's Mike Hoffman saying, or Elliot Friedman saying, Mike Hoffman is considering 1-year contracts, and if you put him in a cushy spot, he can score a bunch of goals, kind of do what Tyson Barrie did, basically.
And I like Hoffman. I think Hoffman's a, you know, you could add essentially a top tier scorer to your roster, and it seems enticing. I don't know how much this makes sense for the Vancouver Canucks. In a Canucks lens, Bic, I don't see it as an easy fit, okay? He's got, of the many goals he scored this year, I think it's 65. He's got 28 goals on the power play over the last two seasons with Florida. Nearly 50%. And he played mostly on the right half wall, which is currently the spot that is occupied by Elias Pettersson. So, If the Canucks are approaching this and thinking about this right now, wondering how they can move money to take a run at Mike Hoffman, first order of business is going to Newell Brown and say, how does this work for the power play? How would you envision moving the pieces around so that we can still get enough value out of Mike Hoffman? And also on the other side, Mike Hoffman's going to want to know, like, where am I playing on the power play? Because I need my numbers to be up so I can eventually get the term deal that I was hoping for.
Yeah. Okay, so the first question we'll post to everyone, 650, is, would you want him, or why wouldn't you want him, Mike Hoffman, on a 1-year deal in Vancouver? Now, the power play thing is interesting because, okay, is there too many cooks kind of thing? Is there too many people that can do one sort of thing? I look at it and I say, get as many talented players as possible, put them together, they will figure it out. Now, Hoffman's a left-handed shot. Pettersson's obviously a left-handed shot. They both can't go on the same side. But Mike Hoffman has had some success back in Ottawa playing on that left side of the power play. And yeah, it takes a bit longer to get your shot off, but A, he's got a quick shot. B, he's got a very accurate shot, and he can get it off and on different platforms. So I'm less concerned about that. And the other thing this does is it puts JT Miller around the net. And if you want an in-tight guy, or maybe even in the bumper, I prefer him lower, but an in-tight guy that has got quick hands, that processes really well, that can be a good passer, it just creates another creative outlet for that power play that can either run really hot or go really stagnant. I want to see a bit more smoothness to that power play, which can be one of the best in the league.
And the thing about that is the Canucks need the power play. They need special teams to have success. You know, not every team relies on it or likes to rely on it so much. But, you know, we saw it in the playoffs. The Canucks lived and died by how they were doing on special teams for a lot of the series, even against St. Louis and even Minnesota. But that's so that's the potential value of Hoffman. But I have questions there. I also wonder about 5-on-5. And are you slating him to play with Bo Horvat, as we've talked about with, you know, Toffoli or whomever? Because Brock Besser doesn't always play as at his high-end level like he does with Petey and Miller, as he did with Bo Horvat and Tanner Pearson. So then you're maybe questioning a drop-off for Besser. And also, he's not a very good defensive player. And the way that Travis Green has used that Bo Horvat line in the past is somewhat of a shutdown line, Bic. And that just doesn't scream Mike Hoffman to me if you're going to continue using that line in that type of a role to have a lot of two-way value.
Yeah, that's tough. It's actually the tough reality of coming up with these ideas of, oh, go get this mercenary on a one-year contract. Someone doing that is only going to want to do that if they're guaranteed playing time with Pettersson and Miller, right? You're not coming to Vancouver and be like, hey, we got this great opportunity. You get to play with Bo Horvat and Tanner Pearson. Great players, don't get me wrong, fun players. But if you're doing it to maximize your value to get re-upped in a year time, you want to play with the best situation possible. Like, there's a reason Tyson Barrie chose Edmonton over Vancouver, right? It's an Edmonton, you know, makes their strength the stronger by boosting their power play. But if you're Tyson Barrie, it's, I can put up 65 points on this power play and have a blast. And ultimately what's going to happen is people are going to look at the numbers and say, man, this guy's a 65 point D-man. That's going to get said if he succeeds there. Whereas in this scenario, it was going to be, you're going to have to play over Quinn Hughes. You're going to have to try to beat Quinn Hughes to play power play one. It's not a likely scenario. And, you know, the reason why I asked of would you even want a Mike Hoffman type to come in here, because you're going to have to play him with Pettersson and Miller. And it brings the question of, like, what does that mean for the status of Brock Besser?
Right.
That if the Canucks were exploring these ideas, and you know, we've heard that they've touched base with Mike Hoffman or other wingers, is it does kind of speak to, like, your sales pitch. Part of your sales pitch is you get to play with Pettersson and Miller, which is great for the player. But what does that mean then mean for Brock Besser? Is his status as a number one winger up in the air?
It definitely feels that way. Look, this team, I'm comfortable going into the season, penciling in the lotto line and being like, we're going to win that matchup most nights. I just need the rest of my guys to be even. I don't love the idea of moving Brock Besser away from those guys in a permanent type of conversation. Brock, we haven't seen the best of Brock. Like, we have in spurts. Mm-hmm. But I think there's just so much more of a player there that injuries continue to knock him off, gaining enough momentum to reach his ceiling for a significant amount of time. And even through this year, with all that we talked about with Brock and questioning where his game was and is and where it's going, and are they getting value because he's not scoring the goals that we expected him to from his rookie year. I mean, the guy was at times on pace for 70 points. And yet we made it seem like he was surplus to requirements, or that he wasn't a big reason as to why the Canucks were having success. I find that really difficult to go to Mike Hoffman and pitch him as, yeah, you're going to play with Elias Pettersson and JT Miller, when Brock Besser is there and he's probably the best option for that line anyways.
Yeah. And it changes the conversation of, and why I go back to, like, would you even want him? And part of that is the player itself. And we're getting a lot of texts here. 650 is, oh, I don't want him for the character reasons. And obviously that dates back to his time in Ottawa. Like, I can't speak of anything on his time in Florida, you do kind of have to allow people for space to recover and reconcile and all that sort of stuff. So I'm not going to speak to the character of things that happened in Ottawa. How has someone been in his most recent tenure is something I would look at. So I see all the texts coming in. I get them. But the reason that if I'm building the case, and look, I've been steadfast of, I think the Canucks should try to, you know, free up room to bring in this type of player. But one of the reasons why you wouldn't is that, like, what role, like, specifically, what's the better value? Finding someone to play on that top line with Pettersson and Miller, or is it more suitable to find someone to play on that second line with Horvat and Pearson? And if you're trying to solve the top six equation, which one do you want to try to solve? It's probably easier and probably better value to solve the play with Horvat and Pearson riddle.
Yeah, and look, I think Granlund, for me, Granlund is the better fit. If all things are equal and they're looking at similar deals to sign with teams, you got to bring back not Marcus Granlund, but Michael Granlund.
Mikhail
Granlund is the better fit because he has more two-way value. He can score a little bit. Probably has been on the lower end. We saw him start to find his offensive game again later on in the season with Nashville, but. You know, since the trade went to Nashville, it didn't really work with him as a fit. And here we are talking about fit constantly. Well, clearly, Michael Granlund had been a better player prior to his time in Nashville than he was these last couple of years. So
he was close to a 70-point guy.
I know, in years in Minnesota. He was really good player, and he's still only 28. I mean, I really wonder what that contract is going to look like the longer we go on here, because he's a player with two-way value that I think suits, can play center in a pinch and can play right wing on that Bo Horvat line with Tanner Pearson and maybe continue them having their two-way value and potentially playing in that shutdown role. And I look further down and I even look at a guy like Anthony Duclair, who I think had more two-way value than most would expect given some of the narrative around him. But not only did he score quite a bit in Ottawa, he was able to keep his head afloat on a really, really bad team from all the underlying metrics. I think that's really interesting if you put him in a better spot and potentially a value deal. But the more I think about it, the more I see other options out there and I see that Mike Hoffman isn't the fit that I'd be looking for with the Vancouver Canucks.
650-650, your thoughts. You can always get them in. This one's from Grimace in Richmond. I only want Hoffman on a short-term deal, maximum 3 years, 30 years old and already not the greatest skater. That's basically what we're talking about, yeah. Right? Elliot Friedman reporting that he's considering a one-year contract just to, you know, reset his market in a year's time where he'll be 31 and under along with Taylor Hall. So, you know, that's something that's why we're bringing this up. It's about short term, not about long term. 650-650 also coming in. Leaf hater Steve Erickson and Beagle or Roussel and picks. Even our first, if we need cap space for a free agent, that's to me is one of the non-negotiables, is not moving a first. I'm not touching Hoglander or put Coles in and probably Rathbone. After that, I'm into pretty much any conversation of how to free up money. And this one's from Jordan Saskatoon says, what if we are bad and we give up a first? And
yeah,
you're in a situation where...
Well, it would have to be top 10 protected, like the Leafs did with Marlowe, right?
Yeah, precisely. So there's ways to, I suppose, leverage yourself and be protected, but... Just generally speaking, unless you're really getting rid of some things, yeah. I'm not touching the first round pick in any sort of cap saving move.
I think the only one would be Louis that you think about doing that. But think about the Marlowe deal. Okay, the Leafs felt like they had to do that to free up space to keep younger guys around and give the money to Andreas Janssen and Kasperi Kapanen at the time. Fast forward 12 months, the Leafs gave up a first-round pick to the Carolina Hurricanes so that they would take Patrick Marleau's contract. And they also had to move out. They decided to just move on from Kasperi Kapanen and Andreas Janssen anyways. Now, yes, they seem to have procured a decent amount of value for those players. They recouped their first-round pick with Kapanen specifically, but you know, it seemed like a big headache in the wake of just if they just would have waited on, you know, letting Marlowe's deal run out, they wouldn't have had to go through all those hoops, essentially. So sometimes, and this year, as we've heard talked about a lot, where teams are really questioning how much they want to go forward with their financial output and what they want their bottom line to look like because of what the season may be and whether or not fans are coming into the picture. Some of this is the best option for a lot of owners is going to just be, let's just let it play out and reassess things next year. Money's going to come off the books and you'll have opportunities to do things then.
Well, I want to get into one other aspect of why we may or may not see Canucks trying to make trades to free up the space. So we'll get into that, plus your thoughts, 650, 650. I guess what I'm going to leave a question for you, text in. Do you believe the Canucks will even make trades to free up the space? Get your thoughts in. We'll touch them on the other side. Bick Nizar, Dan Riccio on the home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.
Now more of Canucks Central on the official home of the Vancouver Canucks, Sportsnet 650.
Sportsnet 650, Bick Nizar and Dan Riccio on Canucks Central, the home of the Canucks. If you want to get your thoughts in on anything about the Canucks offseason, 650, 650 is our text message inbox. Reach, we were just kind of talking about a couple of things before break. And, you know, the priority for a lot of GMs right now is, can we free up money to, you know, go reinvest in the free agent market? Because there's still guys available that are very capable to play in prominent roles on your roster night in and night out. It's not depth guys you're signing at this point. There's still reasonable, you know, middle six, top six players and good D-men available. So yeah, teams are going to want to try to move the money out. But obviously we're in a time right now where RFAs and ARB rulings are coming up and teams are reticent to want to take on cash when some unresolved matters are on their roster. And you know, we've talked so much about the Roussel contracts, the Beagles, the Sutters, the Berchis, the Ericssons, obviously. And I guess my question is, do you believe the Canucks will even make trades to free up this space to try to continue to improve the roster?
I don't feel like we have much evidence to suggest that the Canucks will do that. Jim Benning, a couple of weeks ago on Reach Deep, did say he would not part with a first or second round draft choice in order to move money off of this roster, like we saw the Rangers do with Mark Stahl the year before with Patrick Marleau and the Maple Leafs. So that takes one option off the board for how they go about doing that. And I know there's been some reporting on the idea that maybe they'll think about it in the right situation right now, but it's still more of a mid-round pick or one of your lower-level prospects from everything that I can gather. And even then, I don't know if there's that much of a appetite to do it from a Canucks perspective. Look, this team has had years where they've said, yeah, we will weaponize cap space and in the right situation. And they never did it. Instead, they went out and used it on signing guys to try and help the roster, or at least that they thought would help the roster. So everything that they've talked about in terms of using cap space as an asset, they've never actually done. So even in this scenario where they're trying to give up an asset to gain more cap space, they just haven't made any moves in the Jim Benning era that suggest that they're willing to go down this road.
Yeah, past actions are an indicator of, you know, future actions. And even just look at like the Braden Holtby contract. Yeah. Jim Benning has valued goaltending, right? Bringing in Ryan Miller, and here they were trying to get Jacob Markstrom. What was the first move they made this offseason, right?
Yeah.
If you want to talk about priorities, they prioritized getting the goaltending sorted out immediately, because just by the way that they've always constructed this roster, goaltending has been a priority. So why wouldn't that continue on? And as you're talking about, we haven't seen them weaponize cap space. We haven't seen them, you know, go with the process of trading veteran UFAs to acquire draft picks. We haven't necessarily seen those things. So why is there an expectation where we can see this coming forward of using this opportunity to move cash out? Now, it's a reality that exists. Now, here's the part where I get concerned, where we start talking about, will they make moves to come off of this money? And the thing I get worried about is like the hubris of it all, of here's a player that I drafted, of Jake Virtanen. We've invested this time into him, and now we're at a stage where we believe he's coming into his prime, right? And we know the whole power forwards take time, all that sort of stuff. But the optics, I think, at times can slow down trade talks or slow down the motivations to make trades from the Canucks perspective. And we see it from the fans all the time, Reach, texting in, calling into the post-game shows or calling into our shows, 604-280-0650, if you want to call in, of people saying, don't trade Jake Virtanen. You're at the precipice of what he's finally going to become. Just wait and wait, and you'll see the player he becomes. And we heard it this past season of playoff Jake is coming. And he had great games, don't get me wrong. But it's going to keep persisting of, hey, we're almost at the stage where power forwards become who they are. Don't trade it now. And I feel like at times there's that hubris element of, I drafted him. He's almost there. I'm not going to do it because I still believe. And you can go through like Brandon Sutter. I made the trade to do it, and I'm not really willing to concede that we made a mistake. Think of Erica Branson, signed him to a contract extension when it clearly wasn't working and there was no reason to really extend it. Now it worked out because they get Tanner Pearson, but as far as the process of here's something that we did and we doubled down on it, there's a long history of this GM on his decisions.
Well, I think one of the ones that is really a thorn in the side right now of this team is Sven Berchi, right? Like, think about, okay, they paid a second round pick for Sven Berchi to Calgary and took a chance on him. Highly talented player. He's got some offensive chops, but What was the reason to give Sven Berchi 3 years when he came up for a contract?
See, what's really funny is, so it's 3 years, 3.3, right?
Yeah. What was,
we are sitting here, we're sitting here talking about Jake Virtanen maybe getting $3 million, and he's had as equal as a decent season as Sven Berchi has.
Yep.
Right? That's a stunning part too. And here's traded for this guy, believe in him. Here's $3.3 million over 3 years.
And you had, Berchi had injury issues at the time too. I mean, certainly not what they were with the concussions over the last couple of years, but there was a spotty history. He never really had the 82 game season. It's one thing you can say about Jake. He's pretty durable. He's always in the lineup. It's just, you've made this bet on a player. And it's confirmation bias at its finest, Bick, where you've made this bet, you've seen some inkling that it might come true, and you keep betting on it too, because in your heart of hearts, you want it to believe. Like, he was on pace for 20 goals. Confirmation bias, right? You're buying into your preconceived notions of this player and wanting this thing to come true and not thinking of the downside of it, where you quite clearly now see it with Sven Berchi. At the time, it was a very league average contract. Taking a bet on him. But why did you have to go 3 years on that deal? These are the things that are just eating up the Canucks right now. And it's the only double down that ended up working was Erica Branson, where they ended up flipping him for Tanner Pearson. But if you want to go next level and think about how you can alleviate cap situations, well, you shave a little bit off with Eric Goodbranson. Now Tanner Pearson has a good year. Maybe you can, you know, move on from Tanner Pearson and get an even cheaper asset, maybe a younger asset for Tanner Pearson and move forward with that asset. But, you know, this organization has shown that they don't work in that sense. They just go one move at a time.
It's kind of like the Joker. They just do things, right? Yeah. Does it look like a guy with a plan, or does he just do things, right? And at times it's, okay, we did this move now. How do we fit the next move into what we've just done? It's not always a lot of synchronicity in
synchronicity.
Layering – synchronicity, sorry. Yes. In layering these moves together. I was trying to say synergy and at the same time, so that's why it came out that way. But it's – how do these moves work in combination together? That is something that we don't often see. And, you know, I'm a skeptical that they will make a trade to free up money because of just the marketplace itself, how many teams are willing to take on money, but also B, because the history doesn't really showcase that that's something that this management group has done, despite it having its obvious benefits. And I do look at it right now as the optics, I think, might be driving some of this too, and we'll wait and see, obviously, because it's not necessarily the time and place yet. Because other teams, it's not as if other teams are moving money too, right? It's not as if the Canucks have missed the boat on trading away cash. But I do wonder if the optics of it are also playing a hand of,
yeah.
Well, we'll have to concede that we missed out on this one and we missed out on this one when that point has already been made. That point has been driven home by media and fans alike of, hey, that this Antoine Roussel contract might not be working out. This Brandon Sutter one might not be working out. The Louis Erickson one is an unmitigated disaster.
Yeah.
You know, once we're discussing it and it's obviously come to terms that there's no extraction of value going to happen with those deals, don't worry about the optics at that point. Make the best decision moving forward. And I made this point to Batch earlier this week of every decision, if we approach this, every decision, every conversation I like to have here on these airwaves is framed in the sense of, is this decision improving or maximizing the opportunities Elias Pettersson and Quinn Hughes have in the playoffs? That's how I'm framing every decision. And so I don't care about the optics of losing a trade to free up money, because it's in the long run and in the greater picture, it's helping out those two guys get in the playoffs more often.
Well, the thing about it is, like, the fans have been on the can we get rid of Brandon Sutter train for a long time. So optically, it's almost doing more harm to keep him around.
Yeah, but you know how it'll work. You know how it'll work. Yeah. It'll be like, we told you. Yeah. We told you this whole time. And now you had to get rid of a sweetener. You know, that's exactly how it's going to go.
And that's fair. That's totally fair. But, you know, this part of it, and what you just said is interesting, you know, thinking about it, like the Penguins have done for so many years. Every year we're going in with the idea that we need to give Sidney Crosby and Evgeny Malkin the best chance that they have to win. Because we have those guys, we've got a chance. Canucks are entering that frame of mind, should be entering that frame of mind with Elias Pettersson and Quinn Hughes. So if that is the priority, then they should have been doing their due diligence to see if they could move out Brandon Sutter for a mid-round pick, even at 50% or something like that. If not, you buy him out and maximize your cap space for this year as much as you can. Same thing with Sven Berchi. If you can't find it, buy him out and maximize your cap space for this year. But when they let that buyout window pass, Bick, I think it told us a lot that they're just not willing to do that. They're not willing to cut that check in order to maximize the opportunity for this year. If you're going to do it, you got to get creative and move the money around as best you see fit. And even now, you know, they could go 10% above the cap if they really wanted to and sign one of these guys out there. There's already five or six teams that are playing in fantasy land above $81.5 million. You make that signing. If you think it's really going to help your team, you do it right now and figure out how you're going to deal with the money later.
$650, $650, some some thoughts coming in. This one's from Steven. How much would the Canucks save if they sent Erickson and Sutter to the minors? That's from Steven. So here's the thing. If you send Louis Erickson down, it's you technically save $1 million on the cap.
Yeah.
So he's now a $5 million charge. But here's the thing that gets interesting about all of this is when you're in the AHL, you're not paying escrow, right? So, yes, you are technically saving on the cap, but what are you actually paying out to the player? And that's the part that we can talk about saving money as far as in relation to the cap, but the bigger influence here is, and we've echoed this point for a month now, Reach.
Yeah.
Like the actual cash aspect of this all is driving decisions across the league. And when you're talking about saving money, you're not in a, like real money, you're not in a situation where sending guys down is saving you a lot of money. Any money, to be honest.
Well, the thing with Louis is he's making $1 million in salary this year. So what are we really talking
right,
about?
Right, but we're talking about pinching pennies here, basically, yeah, across the league. Like this is a real thing. It's rather than paying, $1 million, would you rather pay eight? I haven't done the math on it, but I imagine somewhere around range of $780,000, somewhere around there.
Yeah.
Like, that matters. Like, it's under normal circumstances, it hasn't mattered because obviously Sven Berchi last year was sent down, and essentially that was 2.291 or something like that, mm-hmm, against the cap. That reality may not exist in this reality.
So the Schmidt deal, then, it's a perfect opportunity to add a really good player for basically nothing. Right? When is a player like Nate Schmidt ever going to be as cheap as he was in trade value than he was to the Canucks last week? It never happens. Usually, if you're acquiring that guy, mm-hmm, it's because he hasn't been playing well. That's not the case for Nate Schmidt. It was just Vegas felt they had a better player in Alex Pietrangelo. Now, that deal, though, helps the Canucks not just for this year, but it helps them further years. It solves the what's our action plan beyond Alex Edler question. So it's a move that, okay, you're adding money, but it helps this team not just for this year, but in the years after that, gives you some cost certainty as well. A one-year deal for Mike Hoffman, that's just for this year. You're kind of just thinking about this in a very small lens. Are they willing to add money for something that will only add value to this team for this reason, just for this season only? And so far, we don't have much evidence to suggest that they are.
650, keep your thoughts coming in. And yeah, the other thing is, okay, you mentioned Hoffman. We've talked about Granlund, all that sort of stuff. We keep mentioning forwards, and we've heard this from Ian McIntyre, Sat, and Dan Murphy, who all did a great piece yesterday, by the way, at sportsnet.ca. You can watch that. There's this been the sentiment that's been echoed of bottom pairing D-man is going to get prioritized before top six forward. Is that something that we should agree with? And is that a reality, right? Because obviously, if you think from building this out from the back end and follow the priorities here, right, it's get a goaltender, Holtby, check. Get a D-man, Schmidt, check. The defense hasn't been improved from last year. Schmidt's an upgrade over Tanev, yes, but like losing Troy Stetcher right now with no replacement, unless it's Brogan Rafferty or Jalen Chatfield, and spare me on that one just yet, it hasn't been upgraded from where it was.
Well, I've said this a lot with Rafferty specifically. Like, he's in his mid-20s. If you're not giving this guy a chance now, like, basically you're saying he's not really much of a thing. So he's got to get a chance at some point. But a lot of it and a lot of the talk from those in the know has continued to be, well, they're still looking for a defenseman. Well, they're still looking for a defenseman. So I have to think that that is almost as much of a priority as adding a top-end forward, given what some of the reporters around the team are saying. And Look, I think there are blueprints out there. You look at Nashville, you look at other teams with really strong decors. Vegas, you know, in their first year especially, showed, you know, some really strong transition puck-moving defensemen, one on each pair, can really improve the value of your forward group. I wonder if that's the thesis behind really wanting to upgrade the defense. The problem is, what options are out there still remaining to do that, and can you add a defenseman and a forward? I feel like the Canucks are getting to a point where they're making a decision on one or the other.
Yeah, the big thing for with why I would prioritize the defense is, like, in theory right now, best laid plans is, like, Hughes and Myers together, Edler and Schmidt together, ride those top four guys, and you can minimize the minutes. And even if you're in a worst-case scenario of Yule, Levy, and Rafferty is your bottom pairing, which is not something I'm advocating for, but even if that happens, you can, you know, dole out the minutes in a way where their impact on the game gets minimized. They can come along slowly. The issue with that, though, is, man, one injury, that it blows up your plan real quickly. And we know about, you know, how Alex Edler is at his stage in his career, right? He could pick up an injury and be out. And it's that scenario where I fear of, here's this plan, and one injury screws up this entire plan, and suddenly Brogan Rafferty is playing top 4 minutes. That's where I get worried. And that's why I think that the idea of prioritizing D-man over a forward right now speaks where that urgency comes from, because this team in theory shouldn't have problems scoring goals.
Well, they didn't have problems scoring goals last year with this, essentially this forward group, right?
Yeah.
Even when Toffoli came in, I mean, they weren't having trouble scoring throughout their lineup for the most part. They'd go through stretches, but, you know, Elias Pettersson was playing and JT Miller were playing at such a consistent level that they had enough goals on the board most nights. But it's the defense that held them back, not having defensemen that can transition the puck out of the zone, get them from hemorrhaging in their own end, getting them stuck in their own end. That was a continued issue for the last number of years. And it seems like the light bulb has finally gone on, that that's how we change this team. That's how we really begin to change the look of this team. It's like, hey, if we had more guys kind of like Quinn Hughes, that might change the outlook of the rest of our team. Now, you're not going to find any other Quinn Hugheses out there, but can you find guys that do those parts of the game specifically well? Nate Schmidt definitely does. Sammy Vatanen would help in that front. There's a couple of other guys out there, but I think that's what has kind of clicked for the Canucks management and why they're going down this road.
We got to run. My apologies to Mark on the phone line. Sorry, I didn't see it, man. We'll try to get you in on Monday. Feel free to call back. 604-280-0650 if you want to chime in over a weekend. But we got to run here. Reach Deep is on the way. The People's Show coming up here on a fun Friday. Reach, you and Randy coming up in minutes. What's on the way?
We got lots more hockey talk. So if Mark wants to stay on the line, by all means, give us a shout.
Sure.
right off the top. Talk some football. Get ready for week 6 with Matt Verderam. Of course, Dave Pignota and Irfan Ghaffar. A couple of insiders to tell us what's coming next in the NHL offseason.
What might the weekend look like? That's all coming up here on Reach Deep, the People's Show. Thank you for listening to Canucks Central on the home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.